Hello and welcome back to Coffee with Conservationists, the podcast where I sit down with people who dedicate their lives to researching, protecting and documenting nature. I talk to them about issues affecting wildlife, the climate and global biodiversity. We cover diverse topics within ecology, biology, storytelling, activism and much more. My coffee feature today is Plot Coffee Roasters. I'll tell you a bit more at the end of the episode. Today I talk with friend and wildlife filmmaker Ben Garrick. We talk about his final year film In Search of Owls, some of the threats facing owls in the UK, and why he decided over it. Today I talk with my friend and wildlife filmmaker Ben Garrick. We talk about his final university film In Search of Owls, some of the threats facing owls in the UK, and why he dedicated over a year of his life to these stunning animals. Hi Ben, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for coming on all the way from sunny Scotland.
Hello George. Yeah, it's sunny now. It hasn't been sunny most of today, but it's nice at the moment.
That's good. We're here to talk about owls. You lived in my partner's house for a year, so I frequently saw the amount of, I'm speaking from a place of personal experience as like a backseat observer to the pain and suffering and highs and lows that went through this project that we're going to talk about. But overall, I think it turned out incredibly, and we're going to talk about owls, which are a very cool bird, a group of birds. Firstly, we're going to talk about you first for a little bit, if that's okay, because I ask all my podcast guests this, and a lot of people will probably have the same origin story, so we're going to see what yours is, and ask you, like, you did my degree, so marine and natural history photography, so obviously you're into nature and conservation and wildlife. Where did that start? Where did it all begin for you?
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that's a fairly good question. So as you'll have seen, if any of you have watched the film, I grew up in the Peak District, so in the middle of a national park. So I was kind of, my childhood was spent running up hills. We lived next to a hill that was, I think, a mountain by a couple of feet, or maybe that's just what I was told as a child, something ridiculous. So yeah, I think my kind of love for this has just come from, I've always been surrounded by it. I've never grown up anywhere where there weren't trees in every direction. So I remember releasing butterflies as a child, and we had a tiny little pond full of frogs. It's just a little garden, but we had a lot of stuff in it. Yeah, and then moving into another place in Peak District, still full of trees, and then up here, and yeah, I've just constantly been surrounded by it. And of course, I'm the kind of David Attenborough generation. I grew up watching kind of Blue Planet 2, all of the planets. So that's probably definitely played an impact in it. But that's the honest answer.
I think when it comes to talking to a guest who is more leaning towards the traditional side of nature, stuff in general, especially in the UK, there isn't really much of a deviance from that pattern, and that's fine. Like, that's okay. And yeah. I am the Attenborough generation as well, so I'm no exception to that rule, except I do totally different things now, but apart from that, I'm no exception to the rule. You created a film, In Search of Owls, which is very cool. I need to watch it again, actually, because I watched it at like 1 a.m. last time, and it was really good. But it is, yeah, I think it probably, as I said when like I messaged you about it, I think it was probably like I haven't been this emotionally invested in a film. But I think that probably was because I was like a backseat driver to its creation slightly. Like the bits in Cornwall, anyway. Obviously, much of it was made elsewhere. But yeah, I don't think I've been emotionally invested in a journey and a film for a while of you achieving your goal of what you wanted to set out when you made this film. And it's really cool to see that you did. Why did you make it?
It's really good to hear you say that, because that was the reasoning behind it. I didn't want to make another... If I'd lent into the blue chip and tried to create that, you're always going to be making kind of, you know, Planet Earth on a budget. It's never going to live up to that David Attenborough, because I don't have a film crew and 8 years to film it in. It's me and whatever camera I can get my hands on that week. So I'm glad that it was something different. And I'm glad it was you were emotionally invested, because that was what I was aiming to get out the film. So the fact that that's happened is a win for me. The owls came from, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, like I've lived in places with quite a lot of greenery, quite a lot of woodland. I'm quite lucky to say I have. But I've heard tawnies through most of my life. We had barn owls, relatively common where I used to live. I even saw a short-eared owl as a child. You could see them up on one of the roads near my house. So they've always been something that I've gone, that'd be such a cool project to do. But how on earth do you film them? And it would always been one in the back of my mind that I was like, I'm going to photograph all of these owls. But it wasn't until I had kind of the kind of financial freedom and time freedom that doing a project at university gives you, to able to finance and time frame something that big. I couldn't do that now. I'm working and juggling everything around that just doesn't work. But the owls came from kind of a childhood love and a kind of also, what can I challenge myself to do? It's an animal that comes out at night. It's not the easiest one to film. During the day and film when the cameras are actually going to pick anything up. So it was half a childhood goal and half just I thought it would be a challenge and I wanted to give myself something a bit interesting to do.
I think a challenge is probably an understatement.
Yeah,
But
looking back, probably it is.
in hindsight, but it was an incredible result, which is the main thing. I think all creativity is a challenge. A lot of your film focused on issues affecting owls. So there's a lot of light-hearted moments, but there was also a lot of very sobering moments where you talked about owl persecution and conservation. Obviously, I'm not asking you to talk as an expert. That's something I might get on in the future as like a, an actual activist or scientist or something. But as a filmmaker and as someone who is has formed an emotional attachment to this creature, an owl. It depends, obviously myriad of species in that group. But could you tell us a bit about the issues facing owls and why you care?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, to those of you who haven't seen the film or don't have time or anything like that, essentially, your main issues towards owls are the same as a lot of them. It's traffic accidents. We've got a lot more roads now than we ever have. We've got a lot more cars on the roads than we ever have. Barn owls, particularly, quite prone to that. Big water troughs and farmers' fields, also a major issue for barn owls. So that's why a lot of them are now being made with kind of grids and all ways of stopping them kind of going down, either hunting something or going down and drowning in the water troughs. I also touched on the film in urbanization and also kind of the, my brain's gone blank, but like the mechanicalization of agriculture and how these like larger fields with less field margins are kind of cutting out your barn owls and your little owls that would have lived in those field margins and hunted across the field, as the field margins are made smaller and the fields have become more monocultural, I think that's the word. They're
Yeah,
becoming a monocult.
monoculture.
Just one kind of crop growing there. It's cutting down on the amount of mice in there. New farm buildings are also one. So, a barn owl would happily roost in the rafters of a wooden barn with mice all over the floor, but big metal boxes now mean the owls can't get in and the mice can't get in. So they're kind of just being driven out in kind of every area. George mentioned as well the persecution. So that's mainly with short-eared owls. And of course, it's an issue with other raptors. I think red kites, even buzzards, have been, and eagles up here in Scotland. Again, it's mainly because your large moors are shooting moors that are owned by private landowners in the States. And a lot, not all, but a lot of them don't want these large birds of prey on, because they're going to drive off the grouse and the pheasants that are put there to be shot. If you watch the film, Ruth Tingay gives an amazing piece of camera, talks about it, and she runs the Raptor Persecution UK blog, which is definitely well worth a read, and touches on a lot of that stuff in much more detail and knowledge than I have on it. But that's certainly something facing our owl species as well.
That was a great answer. And yeah, I think that the important thing to mention is that you covered all of these issues, but they all have further points to explore.
Oh, absolutely. You could make a film on every single one of them. There's so much going on, and not even with owls as well, like with everything else. It's you know, all of those issues that affect the owls will affect a whole myriad of other creatures in the same thing.
Yeah, of course. I've spoken before on the podcast. We had a fair while ago, actually, when I was first starting out. We got in touch with Megan McCubbin, which is very cool, and managed to get her to talk about raptor persecution in general and that kind of thing. But focusing in on owls, because we didn't really focus on the specific species. Talked about harriers a bit, but not really. Touched on hen harriers, but not owls. What protections are there currently in place for them? So when you say that they get shot by landowners, obviously landowners will deny that because they are protected. But what protections are around them? What kind of trouble will a landowner get in if they are found guilty of that of wildlife crime?
Often kind of not the trouble they should get is the honest answer. I mean, I'm not the voice of reason on this. I know as much as I researched for the film, and I know as much as I've kind of looked into it. But yeah, so there's shooting of them. There's also they'll bait them to come down. And again, it's realistically a very small proportion of these landowners and groundskeepers around the country. But it's enough that, you know, they're getting killed. One is too many. I'm not painting everybody with the same brush. It is a small proportion, but yeah, the brain has gone mush.
It's okay. So it's
Give
my
me a
end, to be
second.
honest.
Yeah, the kind of punishment that they face often really isn't enough, and that's what Ruth Tingay and the raptor persecution team are kind of working to try and change.
Yeah, that's perfect. A perfect answer. Because I think, the reason I wanted to, apart from, you being a friend, and it's great to have a friend on the podcast because it's always a laugh. I wanted to get you on because you have a kind of a varied filmmaker's perspective, and I think a filmmaker perspective can only be so much. I think if I get experts on, somebody who's worked in this very niche specific field of, shorted owl, is it shorted owls that get persecuted the most?
On moorlands, yeah, in that kind of
Yeah.
way, yeah.
So if someone's, worked in the very niche subject of shorted owl persecution, they might talk for hours on this subject, and there's no way that we can fit the nuance of that topic into a podcast episode. Whereas if we talk to you who's researched it for a 30-ish minute film, and you know about editing and conciseness, you can communicate that really effectively. You're a really good communicator of the issues that need to be told, and you won't just kind of turn 10 years of blog posts into a podcast episode, which is
Yeah, I'm not an expert in it, which definitely makes me not the best person to talk about it. But it, like George says, kind of the level of research I've done, I know quite a lot about it, but not enough to talk for hours. I can give you the key points, but like I say, go on the raptor persecution, look at that if it's something you're interested in. Message Ruth. She is yeah, amazing person, and yeah, I was very fortunate to have the chance to meet her.
Yeah, amazing. And obviously ask people to watch your film, because I'll
Oh
link
yeah,
it.
you should
I'll
probably watch it.
watch
Yeah, watch
probably
that
watch
if you
the film,
want.
and then you'll know more about it. We're going to talk about your film now, because that's something I feel you're probably a bit more comfortable talking about, is
Definitely know
generally
slightly
like
more about that.
and potentially know slightly more about that. Firstly, for just added context to what we've talked about so far, you tried to track down every species of owl in the UK. How many are there, and what are they?
Okay, so there's five owls in the UK. You've got your tawny owl, that's your generic kind of twi-twi owl that you'll hear in the woods. You've got your barn owl, that's kind of very light coloured, you're kind of seeing it in farmers' fields, stuff like that. You've got your short-eared owl, so that's more of a moorland bird. If you live up in like the Peak District is quite famous for having quite a few, but also like kind of Staffordshire, anywhere where you've got big open moorland, you're going to have a good chance of seeing them. Long ears is our rarest one, quite similar to the short-eared. But they're a woodland bird who hunt out of the woodland, so they'll have their chicks in the wood and they'll be hunting quite often outside over these open fields. And then our lastly, we have our little owl, which is the smallest UK owl, hence the name. They're very, very cute and kind of they come across very interesting on camera because every other owl is this very swoopy, glidey, your generic owl, whereas the little owl was an interesting one for me to film just from a completely different point of view and completely different to the rest. But yes, five owls we have in the UK.
That's something that a lot of my guests might not know, because you do, as you said, you do have the generic species that everyone knows. I definitely slightly ashamed to say that until a good like maybe 4 years ago, I was probably like 18, 19. Yeah, it wasn't that long ago. It was depressing. I didn't realize that not all owls make the twit twoo. It's not something
I
I was
don't.
like, I
It's
was
probably
like,
embarrassing to say what age I found that out. Yeah, no,
yeah, I was
it's
like,
because you don't.
really?
You think of
It's
an
just
owl, you
one
think of
species?
twitter-twoo.
Yeah,
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
there's lots of screeching and lots of noises, and a lot of them can be mistaken for different ones. But yeah, your generic twitter-twoo is your tawny.
What's your favorite one to film, or what was your favorite one to film? What's your kind of like
Oh
the
well.
high point of the filmmaking process?
Okay. Yeah. So. I mean, the long-eared was incredible to film. It's one of the rarest in the UK. I can't remember the population numbers off the top of my head, but there's not that many of them in the UK. They're popular in some other countries. They've got slightly bigger populations over there. But so the long-eared was a bit of an experience for me of this is something that very few people have seen. It's still so, it's there's not that many people in the see George Googling to see how many long-eared owls there are.
Potentially.
Yeah, there's really not that many. So that was probably the most I felt kind of the most like this is something that nobody else has seen or so few other people have seen that was quite a special one for me. But the most fun to film was probably the little owls. So all of these I was getting up very early, going to bed very late, trying to it's a dusk and dawn to film them, but kind of getting up at 5 o'clock and getting there and you sat there and you. Falling asleep, holding the camera, going, "Oh my God, it's never going to come out!" And these little heads would just pop over the wall and squawk at you. And they're the most, they've got the most character, I think, especially, and they've got the most character to come across on camera. So yeah, they might not be your most glamorous kind of swooping down for prey owl, but the little owls are probably the most fun to film. Go on, how many are there?
It's inconclusive.
It's inconclusive.
Yeah, BTO say a lot, which I think is wrong. So, British Trust for Ornithology says 3,500 breeding pairs, which seems far too many.
I don't think it's that many.
Forestry England says 1,500 to 2,000, and then the RSPB down all the way down here, say estimates around 1,500.
Yeah, I think that's around what I found. I mean,
Yeah.
they're so hard to track down. Also, the same with the long ears, they're with the short ears, they're usually quite solitary, they'll be out and they migrate as well. So trying to get population numbers on a nighttime bird that migrates is always going to be rough around the edges. But it's worth saying the long-eared is our rarest owl.
Yeah. What's your favorite species, just objectively? Sorry, subjectively, rather.
Yeah, my favorite probably still the barn owl because it's the one that to me was the one that I saw as a child. It's the one that if I hadn't seen kind of swooping over the car, I wouldn't have made the film.
That's, yeah,
So it
very
sticks
fair.
with me as the one that I saw as a child, and that's why that yeah. Barn owl is my favorite, but not for any reason other than personal connection. I think
Yeah.
they've all got their own kind of interesting lives and storylines that are just fascinating to watch.
We've talked about the high point, well, the sort of high points of filming specific particular species. Low points, challenges, what was the kind of
All of them.
All of them, cool. Okay.
No, so yes, the so I when I went into making this film, I think I said earlier in the podcast, I wanted to make something that had a bit more human connection. I wanted you to see it's not all you go out and you find it. You see a David Attenborough, they go, oh, here's a penguin, and they're showing you the penguin. I wanted to kind of show that. So it was, yeah, it was different. It was over a year of my life trying to find them all. I did. To those who've seen it, I did actually drive 800 odd miles to try and find them. I
I was about
did.
to ask what the mileage was for the total film.
It's I made a rough estimate. I think I did it in hours. At the end of my film, it comes up as a little statistic. It's been a couple of months since I made it, so I can't remember off the top of my head. But it was too many, and I think I will be planting trees for the rest of my life to offset the carbon footprint of it. But yes, it was a lot of driving, and that was one of the other issues I had. So in the film, you'll see my little blue car. So I had a car kind of give up on me doing it. I actually had two. One never made the final cut because you don't need to see all of that. And also, a lot of my filming was done around my home in the High Peak and up here, where I'm now moved up to Scotland. But I was also at uni while I was making this film, which I opted not to include. I thought it just confuses the storyline a bit. But that, you know, that was another challenge I had. Kind of, I wasn't near these places that I wanted to film and show. I was at uni trying to storyboard it and trying to make it work. So there were certainly challenges. And of course, you've got trying to find it is how do you find it? You know, we don't want if you see these hours, you shouldn't be giving out locations. Some of them are scheduled one, absolutely not. But just in terms of you don't want to be handing out locations of protected birds anyway. So trying to find these was a lot of just looking. It's the only way you can really do it. I got lucky with some friends who had some idea and were able to kind of point me, but finding them was definitely a difficulty. Weather was a difficulty. Everything that cut off, but you know, that's what it's going to be. If you set yourself to do something like that and try and find something that rare, you're going to hit stumbling blocks along the way. And I think that made the film. I think if it had been an easy find, then the film would lose a lot of drama. So although it was annoying at the time, looking back, it was probably quite good from the storyboarding point of view.
Yeah, that's fair. I think that yeah, what makes it more impressive is not only were you at university, you're in at university here where I'm recording now in Falmouth. So you were like Falmouth for people who don't know, UK geography, like me, I'm really bad at it, is like West Cornwall, so it's really far away from literally anywhere. I think the only other university that's further away from like Falmouth to the rest of the UK, maybe the University of the Highlands and Islands, which is one of the Outer Hebrides.
Yeah, I
So
think there is one up that way. Yeah.
yeah, so you can't really get much further than Falmouth from anywhere else. So that it
No.
wasn't, yeah, it wasn't just driving, you know, a bit far. It was driving many hundreds of miles. I
Yeah.
still I will always remember, and I think that, you know, some people listening to this might go, why is it relevant to conservation? But this is how hard conservationists work. I remember you going, we were playing a board game at like 9:30 at night, and you were like, oh my God, was it a tawny? You've been looking for a tawny to film for ages, and it had been spotted in up near Sheffield, which it's a long way away. It's a long way. And you went to bed and then left at, was it 5:30 in the morning? Something like that.
Yeah, it was something like that. Yes, no. So the tawny was actually harder to find in the in real life than it was in the film, as kind of were they all. But yes, I'd been trying to find some locations. I'd got some footage I wanted. I just wanted this. I had a shot in my head I wanted, and yeah, I had a tip off of one kind of up that kind of direction. So yeah, George is right. It was a case of run onto our university campus, ask for a very fancy camera, pack it very carefully in a car, and then leg it several hundred miles north.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's It's yeah. Yeah, I don't really have a yep, no, that I did do that, yes.
No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying this is how, like, you know, it's not just scientists who work this hard. It is filmmakers as well, and storytellers in general. We go to ridiculous lengths to tell the things we want to tell, and yeah, do the things we want to do. And that was a challenge, was the fact you were, you know, a good 400 or 500 miles away from like anywhere where you wanted to work.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I am now technically on the, I'm kind of in the bottom edge of the Highlands. So yes, from here to Cornwall is a bit of a trek. I will pick up on something George was saying about kind of driving that far, because one of the risks to owls that I never looked at was actually a risk from birders and photographers, because they're this very iconic species that birders want to tick off a list and photographers want to photograph. And you know, I'm including myself on that. That was exactly what I set out to do. And while I was creating the film, there were cases of owls being spooked. I think one down in Norfolk with a couple of long ears, and I was kind of keep kind of looking at kind of this stuff. So that is definitely something to take into consideration. Filming barn owls, if you're building nest sites, you need licenses. Like, there's a lot that goes into this, and you don't want to be running after it, chasing stuff back to its nest or anything like that. So I filmed it to the best of my ethics. I never went near nest sites. I kind of kept my distance from everything. But if anybody else is like, that sounds amazing, I want to see this, absolutely do. You should, if you get an opportunity to go and watch an owl, any of them, do it. It's amazing. You won't regret it. But be careful, because they are protected in a lot of cases, and when they're not, you know, you don't want to disturb them. They're a beautiful creature. You want other people to be able to see them. So
Yeah, exactly.
worth mentioning to just take care and just use your head. If you see something like that, don't
Yeah.
text all of your friends exactly where it is. But if you get a cool photo, do send it to me. Tag me in it. I'd like to see more photos of owls. I'm still not fed up of them somehow, several years, well, a
Somehow,
year and a bit later.
I don't quite know that, how that happened, but yeah, I was going to mention, we don't have time to talk about it today, but in episode 22 of the podcast, which is a long time ago now, I spoke to our course mate Charlotte Foote, all about Schedule One licensing and how it applies to wildlife photography. So if you want to go listen to that, that's she's a licensed bird ringer. And this, you know, she was a part of this film as well. Being able
Yeah,
to,
I was about to say, yeah, I Charlotte was the reason I was able to film barn owls, was because I was able to kind of get in with them and film from a distance, not kind of interrupting what they're doing. But yeah, George is right. And Charlotte is a good friend of both of ours, and definitely worth the watch. I haven't listened to that episode. I didn't know it existed, which is really bad.
that's
But
okay. Not many
do,
people.
because yes, Charlotte is an amazing human being, and yeah, very knowledgeable about birds and everything bird related. Sorry,
Yeah,
go on, George.
that's okay. No, it is. It's actually one of my favorite episodes. It's all about bird ringing, Schedule One licensing, wildlife photography, making nature safe and accessible for everyone. So it's a really cool episode. It's actually the first one I recorded in person post COVID as well, post lockdown. So that was fun. But that's that again highlights the amount of work that, you know, filmmakers like you have to do to get in touch with scientists and with wildlife experts and bird ringers and citizen scientists and all these people. It's not just, you know, you going rogue with a camera, run and gun shooting. It's a months and months and months of research and development and best practice and ethics and writing and risk assessing and everything, which is, yeah, I think for this product that you've created out of it, this end product, this film is that doesn't really ever get shown. The amount
No,
of
no. And
intensity.
if anybody's thinking of doing something similar, cool, do it. Yes, absolutely. Go film stuff, go photograph stuff. Do it. And if you need any help, I'm sure is there some way to contact me that you can link on this podcast?
Yeah, I'll be linking
There'll be
it in a
something.
sec.
But
That'd
yes, no, absolutely, and I'm happy to pe point people in directions to people who can help. But yeah, filmmaking takes a lot of work, and most of it's sat in front of a desk trying to figure out how you can make something shot in autumn not be shot in autumn, which I
yeah.
remember was a big one for me. And it is, it's the planning, it's the contacting, it's finding the people you need to talk to, finding the licenses you need, the everything before you can even pick up a camera and go out and find what you want to find.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's why I wanted to talk to you personally and about this film, because it's not, yeah, I want the label of a conservationist when I talk about coffee with conservationists, although I'm not drinking coffee right now,
Neither am I.
to be
It's a
very
bit too late.
broad, to be very broad, and encompass filmmakers and activists and storytellers as well as the people who have a BSc or an MSc or a PhD or whatever. Because that kind of thing, conservation and wildlife and caring about nature doesn't need a qualification, I think.
Yeah.
Although as of Monday, we will both have one, which is very weird.
Yeah, not sure how I feel about that, but we'll
Yeah, it's
gloss over
fine.
that for the moment.
We'll yeah, we'll cry on the phone together later. But I'm sure you've done brilliantly. Talking of
As
you
I'm sure
doing
you have.
brilliantly, generally, what's your future planning? I know you're not really filming at the minute, you're just working as much as possible, but what does the future hold for Ben Garrick filmmaking
Yes.
media work?
absolutely, yes. So I am planning on a sequel to the film, not on Owls. I'm cautious to share too many details until I have a plan, but it will be Scotland based, given that's where I am, and I do want to cut down on my amount of travelling. Unlike the other one, I want to make a more close to home, almost kind of, searching your garden, something that I know I'm privileged to live where I am. I'm in the middle of a forest, quite literally. It's like several miles before you get to a paved road, but just looking in your garden and kind of basically just making a film of me going looking for things, because that's what I like doing. And if and yeah I don't know what the latest film is on YouTube, but I think it's about 7 or 8 thousand people have seen it and apparently like watching that too. So if I yeah I'm planning on making another one of them. I'm working with a much larger production team on an actual wildlife film, which I'm again can't share any details on yet. But that will be, I'm very excited to be on board, because similar to mine, we're showing a wildlife film in a very different way, where it is blue chip but in an interesting way. So I'm quite excited to be part of that. Yeah, and anything else that comes this way, yeah, kind of working a bit freelance and running up and down the hills and seeing what I can find currently.
Yeah.
If anybody has any, if anybody from the BBC is listening and wants to give me a job, I have a film to show you. But yes, no, generally I'm just going to be out in the woods filming as much as I can, and yeah, working in pubs and kind of
Yeah.
trying to make myself be able to live at the same time.
Nice. Absolutely plug this to as many BBC people as possible. I'm sure I have a few BBC people following me. I know I have definitely a load of like nature celebrities, that kind of clique of people with big followings, but I don't know if I have any NHGU people following me yet. But I will keep sharing it, obviously, and I will link your film, which leads me on to the next question. Or actually the last question. So I'll ask you this one first and then I'll ask you a different one. Because we're running out of time and we might have
I
to
was going to
start a
say,
new
not to.
meeting.
In I was going to say, should we start a new meeting now rather than it cut us off halfway through? Because we've only
Yeah,
got a
that's a
minute and
really
a bit
good idea.
left.
We've only got like two more questions, but for the sake of ease, we're gonna start end it here
Yeah.
and start a new
Also, I want to
one.
chat to you after and know what's going on in your life. So
Cool,
we'll start a new one. Right, send me a
yeah.
link.
So for the
Yeah.
second time today, I am having to restart a meeting because this podcast does not earn enough money to pay for Zoom Premium. Sorry, Zoom. And I will be forever restarting meetings for the last two questions, which I think is really fun. We left it off by talking about the kind of your future work, which sounds really, really exciting. And lots of I'm sure you had to sign lots of cool things for this other cool thing, which I'm looking forward to hearing about at some point in the future. The kind of almost final question: how do you take your coffee?
I don't know. I've worked in enough pubs that I just kind of consume it in whatever form it arrives. Strong oat milk, no sugar.
Strong oat milk, no sugar.
There you
That's a
go.
good way to go. That's a good way to go.
But I'm going to disappoint that it's probably cheap instant coffee that is almost certainly out of date. So it's probably not the coffee that George would normally be drinking if he hadn't gone for water instead.
Yeah, I mean, I do actually have some decaf in the other room, but I had one while I had my previous guest on because I booked everything way too close together to have two coffees, even if they are decaf.
Reasonable.
And you don't have to have fancy coffee to be on the podcast. I talk to a lot of scientists. I say this a lot. We just drink coffee. I'm not a scientist, but like field work people, we just drink coffee how it comes. We appreciate specialty coffee. We talk about ethical, sustainable, environmentally friendly coffee. But if it's hot and it's caffeinated, we drink it. This is how it
Yes.
goes.
Yes, from living with George, I have politest way of putting it, stolen George's coffee. And he's permitted me to steal it, but I have stolen George's nice coffee, and it is nice. But it's not what I normally drink. No. And I've met a lot of people out doing stuff, and the birders and the photographers and the wardens for a lot of places. And yes, a flask with something hot which has caffeine in it is all that
That's
you need.
all that we need. Talking of future work, how can people find you? How can people keep updated on what you're doing?
Ben Garrick Media on pretty much all socials. I'm on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, anywhere. If you search Ben Garrick Media on it, I'll probably be there somewhere. My website is www.bengarrick.com. There's an email on that. I will probably change because I'm doing a bit of revamping anyway, so I won't give out my email, but it'll be on my website if you want it, or direct message me on something. I'm always happy to help with any project, OWL related, Scotland related, anything related. I might have a contact, I can't promise, but I've made a fair few. So if anybody's doing a project or just wants a chat or wants to know more about the owls or anything like that, yeah, drop me a message. I'm always up for finding new people. And if you've got a cool animal that you think I'd be interested in filming, let me know. I'm definitely down for that.
Very cool.
There you
I
go. That's
think,
where I am.
yeah, I think we should finish with announcing the current running total, which is 8,073 views on your YouTube video,
There you go. There you go.
and some very impressive retweets from quite famous names, I think.
Yes. Yeah, I've had a couple of the Swing Watch presenters enjoy it so far. So
Yeah,
there's the hope.
that's
Missed out
very
on
cool.
Swing Watch this year, but maybe next year.
You never know. You never
You
know.
never know.
So, yeah, thank you so much, Ben, for hopping on the podcast. As I said before, it's always a pleasure to have friends on. I find it I'm quite easy talking to anyone, but I find it a lot easier to chat to a friend because it's less an interview and it's more just like, hey, what's up?
It's a
This is
catch up.
cool.
I haven't seen you in like 3 months. This is a catch up.
Yeah, this is a catch up. Exactly. So
2 months, a month, I don't know.
a
I've
month.
lost track of
It's
time.
only
A
been a
month.
month.
It's only been a month. It's felt a lot longer.
I mean, third year, the final weeks of third year were kind of we didn't see each other despite living in basically the same house the whole time. It was a blur. And yeah, it's entirely fair enough to think it's 3 months because it felt like it was just a whirlwind of I was in a field 24/7, you were in a different field 24/7.
Yeah, actually, in the last month, I was mainly under a blanket trying to get a voiceover to sound
Yeah,
semi-normal.
entirely fair.
Don't do a voice. Yeah, if you don't like the sound of your voice, don't do a voiceover, because even if you do, you'll hate it by the end of it.
I mean, I don't like the sound of my voice, and I've done a podcast for 3 years.
Fair point.
It's not
You've
a great
made it
idea.
slightly worse there. Yeah.
Sometimes you do what you gotta do, but it's not fun. But yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I'm gonna end the recording here, and we can have a little natter. But
Thank
people
you for
don't need
having
to
me.
hear that.
It's been great. I've thoroughly enjoyed this chaotic 40 minutes or whatever it's been. And yes. Nice to meet everybody else in the internet world. I don't know how podcasts, I don't really listen to podcasts. That's what I found out doing this.
It's entirely fair. All right. Have a lovely evening,
Right.
Ben.
Have a lovely evening, George. I'm going to speak to you in like 5 minutes.
Thanks again to Ben for taking the time to speak to me today. You can find links to his social media and watch the film below. My featured coffee today is from Plot Coffee Roasters. This coffee is from a community lot in Mexico. The Peña Colorada Group is not a formal co-op or association, but rather a community-led producer group. Plot Coffee Roasters focus on ethical, long-term relationships with small-scale producers, and have a focus on transparency, publishing the price they pay for each lot of coffee. The link to their website will be as ever in the description, along with more information on the specific coffee above. Thank you all so much for listening. I've been your host, George Stephen Jones, and this is Coffee with Conservationists.